Time to check in with Chad Finn of the Boston Globe and Boston.com. Hello there, Chad.
Hey, Rich. How's it going?
Not great outside. There were snow flurries here a while ago. I'm troubled by that.
Oh, and I was just about to complain about the wind down here in the Maine, but I guess I shouldn't.
No, well, we've got that too. But hey, it's Maine. It's April. These kind of things happen. A lot going on, but I wanted to talk first up about a couple of terrific recent pieces you had. One I just loved because, like so many people, it was a show that opened my eyes and opened the doors of the sports world and even to sports I had never heard of. The 60th anniversary of the debut of ABC's Wide World of Sports.
I thought you were going to say Hee Haw.
Well, there's that too, yes.
Talking about 70s TV shows. Yeah, I wrote about that this weekend. It was actually my editor's idea about a month ago. They happened to notice that the 60th anniversary of the first episode of Wide World of Sports is coming up. I think it's April 29th. And asked if I wanted to do a look back on it. And clearly, it's incredibly influential on what we watch on TV today, but I had no idea how much. I mean, the things that program innovated in the 60s and into the 70s, and even when it started to lean in the 80s, it was underwater cameras and pools, and they actually put a camera and mic'd up Jack Kemp, the old Bills quarterback, in a 1961 AFL game, so it was the first time a player was ever mic'd up, and on and on with things like that. And then, of course, it just introduced the world to the American fans to a whole bunch of sports around the world. Pretty much anything you can imagine as a competition, Wide World of Sports aired it at one time or another. And a lot of the stuff you see in the Olympics today that are primary Olympic sports, gymnastics and a couple others, figure skating for one, really became popular because Wide World of Sports started giving them TV time in the 60s. So incredibly, incredibly important show in the history of sports television.
And one of the big reasons for its success was the versatile and low-key Jim McKay, who just had a certain gravitas without being over the top.
Yeah, as everyone in the sports broadcasting knows, the ability to talk when things are going wrong is a great skill to have. And he was great at dealing with all the technical difficulties they had in the early days on that show, where he could talk eloquently about anything and kind of BS his way through it while, you know, the camera wasn't working or that sort of thing. But he was incredibly respected, so respected as a host that even Howard Cosell said nice things about him in one of his 50 autobiographies that he wrote about himself. Spoke very highly of McKay. Now, if you read my research for this was basically memoirs of all the people involved because they're all gone now.
Right.
They've all passed away now, but and did years ago. But McKay said it wasn't quite that simple with Cosell. Cosell was really envious of McKay's prominence within ABC News and 1972 in Munich when the 11 athletes were murdered. McKay was on the air for 16 straight hours. And Cosell was ranting behind the scenes that he didn't get to go on and be on the news and, you know, make it in the center of that story. So a lot of history there for sure. But McKay is somebody who's universally respected. And his son is Sean McManus, who's the CBS Sports president. And he's about the most normal, down-to-earth television executive you'll find these days anywhere. So I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
And you mentioned Cosell, and as you point out in the piece, it was through Wide World of Sports, and particularly his association with Ali, that Cosell rose to national prominence.
Yeah, for whatever character flaws Cosell had, and there were many, massive ego being probably number one, he was ahead of his time in terms of equal rights and fighting for the black athlete. He was a close friend of Jackie Robinson. Ali, part of their relationship was comical, but very much of it was serious too. And he believed in Ali's right to change his name and to not go to the Vietnam War and all these extremely controversial things that he did during his heyday. Cosell had his back, and I'm sure cynically, part of that was the fact that Costell liked being attached to Ali and the attention that that brought him, but he also seemed genuinely authentic in caring about the plight of the black athletes and making sure everybody had an equal opportunity, which was, you know, pretty wasn't that common back then for somebody of his age and background.
We're talking with Chad Finn here on Downtown. Another recent piece of yours talked about the situation that NBC Sports Boston has gotten itself into that we saw and heard last week when Brian Scalabrine, who I think is very, very entertaining as an analyst, but had to try and do double duty as the play-by-play guy.
Yeah, it was a lot to ask. It was, I believe, the Tuesday night game, a Monday night game against the Bulls. Danny Ainge on as the analyst, which is a great opportunity. You're limited in what you can ask him because he's not allowed to talk about the players on the other team, and he could face tampering things if he says, Lauri Markkanen's a great player, I'd love to have him on the Celtics, anything like that. So you were limited to 50% of what you could talk about right away. But Ainge knows what he's doing on TV. He was an analyst for TNT and spins a medium, and he was really good at it. But the problem is they put Scalabrine in an untenable position. He had to sort of handle the play-by-play while also leading Ainge into the conversation. They weren't sitting next to each other. Ainge was across the arena, sitting in his usual seat with a headset on. So Scal had all these things to juggle, and he's not a play-by-play guy in the first place, so that's hard enough for him to do with Mike Gorman having the night off. So they just asked a lot of him, and he's hit or miss to me. I think he can be condescending to the other people on the broadcast, but I think he's really good as a in-game analyst, and it was just asking too much of him. They've got to add a backup play-by-play guy to their roster, because Mike has in his latest contract the ability to take time off during the regular season. It's been going on for a couple of years. He deserves it. It's great, but when he's out, you can't just kind of piece it together and have, for lack of a better word, an amateurish broadcast. And I thought they did that the other night with a great opportunity to have, with having Danny Ainge on there with him.
And I don't know if she's done play-by-play in the past. I'd love to see them give Abby Chin a shot.
Yeah, I don't know if she has. I mean, it took some acclimation for her to get used to the studio this year, but you're not the first person to say that to me today either, that they thought Abby should be the person to get the chance. I don't know what her experience with that is. I think she's been more the sideline type of reporter in her career. Before she was in Boston, she was working out in Portland, I think, on Blazers broadcast. So that's been more her niche, but if that's something she wants to do, it would be watching them to prepare her for and give her a chance. But in the meantime, they need somebody that can just come in and fill in a couple of games when Mike isn't going to be around, because they've had to juggle it too much. They had Chris Mannix do it early this year. I know one day they called Sean Grandy at 3 o'clock before a game and said, hey, we kind of need you. And Grandy couldn't leave the radio broadcast because it would have left his fill-in on the broadcast all by himself, because Max was out. So they just got to beef up that depth chart a little bit.
Well, speaking of the Celtics, we're going well for a while, and now back-to-back losses, disappointing effort in their game with Charlotte. What does this team need? And I would say not just for the rest of this season, but even looking into next year, there seems to be something missing of late.
Yeah, I'm not one of those get rid of Danny, get rid of Brad people. They're both really good at what they do, but I'm about out on this team. I know there are extenuating circumstances that have affected this year. They've lost the most games to COVID of any team in the league. Even until the Charlotte game, when they were without just Rob Williams, that they really haven't had the group together at all, but still the effort that they put out sometimes just leaves you scratching your head. And some of their issues are so obvious, and they fix them sometimes, and then they regress back to the terrible habits. It's Jason Tatum, dribble, 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 step back three. That's the best shot you can get with 10 seconds left on the shot clock. And it's a great shot when he makes it. He's a great offensive player sometimes, but his own ability covers up for some pretty bad basketball decisions sometimes. And they've had moments where they recently with the 16 winning streak where they moved the ball really well. They looked like they figured it out. And I just get the sense of this team, they think they can flip the switch and play the right way during the regular season, during the postseason, and it's not going to work that way. They're going to be in for a rude awakening. And you can tell it's frustrating Brad because he told them yesterday, we're playing lackadaisically on defense like we're playing against ourselves, where we know they're not going to make the extra pass. And, you know, kind of damned them both ways there. So I don't think it's happening this year for whatever reason. They've got excuses, they've got reasons, but ultimately they're just a really frustrating group right now.
Not so frustrating, the Boston Red Sox, top of the division, first place with a 14-9 record. And we've talked about the fact that they'll likely go as far as their pitching will take them this year. I would say a mixed bag when it comes to the starting rotation. Obviously, Erod, and despite Saturday overall, Nate Eovaldi's been very good, but Garrett Richards has been a nightmare, and I have no confidence in Martin Perez.
Yeah, Perez is just, he's your fifth guy. I mean, he is what he is. Richards is the one that is going to be exasperating, and he's not going anywhere. They're paying him $10 million. A thing that's really important to Chaim Bloom and this organization right now is building up quality depth of that organization, having somebody like Tanner Houck available. And if they call up Houck and he struggles because he hasn't mastered that third pitch yet, and they really, as great as he's been, they think he would hit a wall in the major leagues because he's a two-pitch pitcher right now. That happens, what then? What's your solution? You have to go out and trade for somebody else. You call somebody else up from the minors. They don't want to run into those depth issues that they ran into last year. So they're going to give Richards every chance to be the pitcher they think he can be. He's frustrating because he walks the ballpark, but you can see he's got pretty good stuff if he can just figure it out. But the really encouraging thing to me is the bullpen's good. I know a lot of Eno's had ups and downs. They're still walking too many guys, but a lot of the pieces really fit into the right spots there. And then Selmer and Whitlock in particular, like people can really help that they kind of got for nothing. So if you can shorten the games Martin Perez pitch and Garrett Richards to five adequate innings out of them, your bullpen's going to help you win a lot of games, especially the way this team scores runs. So, you know, they had a little bit of a hiccup lately, 500 homestand, but I still think they're a pretty good team.
Well, and nothing that goes wrong is the fault of a guy who I think is off to an MVP kind of start. And sometimes he's overlooked because he doesn't, for whatever reason, get the media coverage of others. But man, oh man, Xander Bogaerts is such a treat to watch.
Yeah, he just keeps getting a little bit better and a little bit better. You know, one season he's really good, and he's a little more than that the next year and the next year. And then you look up, he's 28 years old, and one of the best players in the American League, but you're so used to it, and there's not a lot of flash there.
No.
That he just kind of gets taken for granted. You know, so many great shortstops in baseball right now, but it's kind of silly when somebody like Bo Bichette seems to get more attention than Bogaerts does, just because, you know, he's got the long hair and his father was a player and came up and tore it up as when he first came up with the Blue Jays. But Bogaerts is somebody who's been doing it for really a long time now. He was their second best hitter in the 2013 World Series as a 20-year-old, man. He had the rough year after that, but has been a very, very good player for a long time, and starting to creep up those all-time lists for the Red Sox. He's going to play his 1,000th game soon. He's gaining on Nomar in some categories and has a chance to go down as maybe the all-time best at his position if he's here for another 6 or 7 years.
I mean, he's already better than Derek Jeter, right?
Who isn't, man? Come on.
All right, is there anybody not named Bill Belichick, okay, maybe John Bon Jovi, who has any idea what Belichick is going to do in the draft?
No, nobody knows. I mean, because it's dependent, I think, a lot on what the Niners do. In a couple of cases, we still don't know whether they're going to take Mac Jones or Trey Lance or Justin Fields seems to have some momentum as the guy they like with that number three pick. And then there's the whole Garoppolo factor and whether they move on from him now or they wait a little bit to move on from him, or if they're serious and that they're going to keep him in his huge salary on the roster this year after spending a number three pick and a quarterback. So I think Garoppolo would be back here in a heartbeat if they let him go, or if they willing to trade him for a third pick. But, you know, if that doesn't happen now, I don't know how that or doesn't influence what the Patriots are going to do. But I'm just prepared for nothing to be a surprise this week. Anything they do Thursday is, other than trading up for, like, a skill player that's not a quarterback, that would surprise me. But anything else, it feels like is all fair game. This is pretty fascinating stuff from Patriots first-round pick standards.
Absolutely. Chad Finn of the Boston Globe. Chad, thanks as always for joining us this afternoon. Have a good week or so, and we'll check in with you again before too long.
You got it, man. Good talking to you, Rich.
Thanks, Chad.